the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The city of Tijuana is struggling with the caravan of Central Americans coming to the United States seeking asylum status. President Trump has seen his efforts to rebuke and stop those crossing the border come to naught in court. We'll talk about the latest developments on immigration next on Air Talk. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific Thanksgiving week. Pleasure to be back with you today. And thanks to John Raby for hosting yesterday. Doing a great job. He always does. Such pleasure to hear John back in the host seat as he was yesterday. I appreciate it very much. And I also very much appreciate your generosity during our abbreviated on-air member drive last week. Less than half the time to raise the same amount of money. We delayed till after the election, and wow, did you come through. Every day it seemed like it was just seconds left on the clock, but we did it. We made all of the challenges, met all of our goals. I can't thank you enough for your generous support of Air Talk and Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we're going to look at a lawsuit in UCLA, a professor there and a new Asian American organization have filed the lawsuit against UCLA seeking admissions data to try and determine whether the university in violation of Proposition 209, takes race and ethnicity into account in its admissions process. But we begin with the latest on the immigration front. A federal judge barring the Trump administration from a blanket refusal to those crossing the border illegally seeking asylum in the United States. A Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judge said that he would put into place for another couple of weeks a restraining order on the ability of the administration to blanketly turn away those seeking refugee status who come in to the country illegally. So the question is, what is that going to mean for the immigration court system? We have seen an explosion in the number of people coming largely from Central America with their families, with kids, since the Trump administration ended its separation of children and parents. That has led to a dramatic increase in the number of families that are coming from Central America seeking asylum. Reporting on that phenomenon is Robbie Whelan, reporter for The Wall Street Journal based in Mexico City. He's been reporting on the migrant caravan. Robbie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've had a chance to talk with people who were part of the caravan, migrants making their way north. And what have they said about how the U.S. and its refugees' policies are affecting what they see as their prospects to be able to live in the U.S.?
Well, it's a range of responses. But one thing to remember is that this story about the migrant story is very much a human story, and it's about conditions in countries like Honduras and El Salvador and Venezuela that are very hard for us as Americans to understand in terms of kind of the poverty and the horrible crime that they face on a day-to-day basis down there. But in another sense, it's also a policy story, and it's a story about incentives. So while the typical migrant might be very poorly educated and maybe doesn't have much more than a second or third grade education in a place like Honduras, they do talk to their family in the U.S. They do talk to friends who've made it to the U.S. and who are living there and working there. And a type of gossip network kind of forms that basically says, so while you might not understand exactly what the dynamics are with Trump's proclamation from last week preventing people who crossed illegally from seeking asylum, but or you might not understand exactly when the child separation policy was ended, but you might have somebody in the U.S. who's calling you and saying, now is a good time to come and you should bring your kids. And so what we've found when we've talked to members of the current caravans that are winding their way through Mexico is that a lot of them do have relatives, do have friends who say that your ticket into the U.S. is to bring your kids and to seek asylum. And that there's two ways of doing that. Obviously, one is to cross between border checkpoints, crossing the Rio Grande in Texas or the desert in California or Arizona, and surrendering yourself to the Border Patrol or getting caught by the Border Patrol. And you have a right under U.S. law and international law to petition for asylum once caught. And then the other way is to go across the bridge and enter the legal way. And once you're on U.S. soil, you are able to present yourself to customs and say, I'd like to seek asylum. I fear for my life in my home country. And the process begins there. But what the Trump administration has done, and this is what our story was about over the weekend, was basically they've tried to cut off both of those avenues by which migrants have a chance to present themselves and petition for asylum. And the first way was through this proclamation that was overturned today by the federal court in San Francisco. And the second way is by drastically cutting down on the number of people who are allowed to set foot on U.S. soil and seek asylum. And that's sort of a more informal policy. And it's one that the administration doesn't like to talk about very much. It's one that the Border Patrol won't even really admit to doing. But when you go and you talk to these migrants in places like Tijuana, Mexicali, San Luis, all these border towns where people are camped out on the sidewalk waiting to cross, they'll tell you that usually when there's 30 or 40 families let in every day to make an asylum petition, that number has really fallen down to one or even no families allowed per day.
So they're just being turned away, and you're saying that's under the claim that it's excessive numbers, that there is, and is that a de facto limit, or is there an actual stated in policy limit?
There's no limit stated in policy, and there's also no reason generally given for why certain numbers of migrants aren't allowed to pass to ask for asylum. What the Border Patrol will tell you is that there are capacity issues, and there are, to be fair, capacity issues on the U.S. side as well. There are detention centers where migrants are held for a certain period of time, depending on whether or not they have kids with them, or depending on whether or not they've asked for a bond versus parole, which are two different processes for releasing migrants. And there are huge capacity issues. You know, a colleague of mine was remarking to me the other day that at Tijuana, at least, and in California, the border crossings in California were designed for a surge of Mexican migrant laborers in the 90s. And that's what the infrastructure they have there is really designed to handle. They're not designed to handle 5 or 10,000 Central Americans who are fleeing gang violence and trying to establish a new life that's safe in the U.S., arriving all at once at the border and asking to be let in. And so, while there are capacity issues on the U.S. side of the border, there isn't a lot of explanation given for why people are not being allowed to enter legally and seek asylum.
We're talking with Robbie Whelan, Wall Street Journal reporter, who's been reporting on the migrant caravan and what the impact of U.S. policies are on what we're seeing in the composition of the caravan and the surge in the numbers of individuals who are coming from Central American countries in crisis, coming to seek refugee status in the United States. Briefly describe for us how the process is different for a single man, you know, the traditional border crosser coming looking for work, for economic opportunity. You know, what happens to that individual if he's seeking refugee status versus a family that arrives at the border, you know, seeking the same designation? How's it different?
That's a good question. The first thing to understand is that the first step in the refugee or asylum process is that the petitioner has to pass what's called a credible fear interview, meaning they have to establish in a room being interviewed by an immigration agent that they fear violence, death, torture, some sort of negative outcome that's a grave threat to them if they return to their home country. Once they pass that exam and once they establish that fear exists, they're allowed to stay for a certain short period of time in the U.S. while a case is created in the immigration court system. For parents with children, it's illegal under current law to hold children under a consent order from a couple of years ago. It's illegal to hold children for more than 20 days. So, and because the family separation policy has been ended for the time being, you have to release the entire family, because you can't just release, you can't separate a family by releasing one part of it. So 20 days is about the limit you can hold somebody while you, after they pass a credible fear exam, if they have children. So for young men who are single, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry. So you're going to say the difference for a young single man is?
Right. So a young single man who has no documented proof that they face a threat in their home country, if they're purely coming for economic reasons to find a better job that pays better, they are almost certainly not going to receive an asylum claim. They might pass. They might pass a credible fear exam, because the standards for credible fear interviews are fairly low, and I think something like between 75 and 80% of people who do those interviews are granted a credible fear designation. So young men might be able to pass that exam, but they almost certainly will not be awarded an asylum claim. Here's where it gets interesting, because in between those two statuses, having passed a credible fear exam and being granted or denied asylum, there's a period of months or even years. You referred, when we first started, to the backlog in the immigration courts. There are more than 700,000 cases in the backlog right now. So what that means is, if you're given a court date after you pass your credible fear exam, there's almost zero chance that you're going to have a court date within 3, 4, even 5 months at this point, the way things stand right now. So in that time period, as the detention centers, which are essentially just jails, as they fill up and as they need to make room for new crossers, for new migrants seeking asylum, they tend to start releasing people. And they release people on either on bond, which means you post $10,000 bond or something in that neighborhood. You raise money from friends and family that you have in the U.S., and that bond is meant to ensure that you'll show up for your court date in 6 months.
And in the meantime, you're able to potentially get employed and be in the United States for a while, and at the very least be able to be safe and to make some income while your status is being determined.
Exactly. That is the incentive that draws people, even if they're not fleeing threats of violence. That's the incentive that draws people who, and to be sure, it does draw a lot of people who are fleeing violence and who just want to be safe for a certain period of time. But people who are just looking for a better job, just looking for better economic opportunities, that is the incentive that draws them, is the idea that they might be released because the system is so clogged and have a chance to stay. I mean, some of them surely will disappear into the shadows and they'll live in the U.S. and work as long as they can until an ICE agent finds them or someone else finds them and they're deported. Others will show up for their court dates and do their best to try to make an asylum claim and be granted more permanent residency status. And others will give up completely and be deported back to their home countries. But that period in the middle is really crucial for a lot of immigrants. Some of them are released with ankle bracelets. Some of them can't make bail, and so it takes a long time to replace them and to release them, and they stay in these detention centers for a long time. But that is sort of the hole that Donald Trump always talks about in our immigration policy, that sort of allows people to stay for longer than he thinks they ought to stay.
We're talking with Robbie Whelan, Wall Street Journal reporter based in Mexico City. He's been reporting on the migrant caravan from Central America up to the U.S. border. Also with us, immigrant rights advocate Nativo Lopez, who's with the Hermandad Mexicana based in Santa Ana. Mr. Lopez, good to have you with us again. We're seeing a tremendous increase in the number of families who are coming. What do you think is the best way to deal with that?
Well, first of all, I want to compliment the reporter. He's done a very good job explaining what the situation over there is. We should follow the law, and the law is that an individual have an opportunity, have a right to make a credible claim of political asylum, to enter the United States legally, when the administration is reducing and restricting that right for individuals to present a claim legally, then they're essentially forcing people to go the illegal route. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen. That's exactly what is happening. with an increased number of individuals coming to the border with Tijuana. But there's context here that's not being spoken about, and that is that whether it's 5,000, 7,000, even a high number, which is exaggerated, 10,000 migrants participating in the caravan to arrive to the north, literally between 30 and 50,000 individuals attempting to come to the United States, not authorized, are being detained and rebuffed and deported from the United States on a monthly basis. Last year alone, there was something like 465 individuals that were detained and deported from the United States. 85% of those were from Central America. Only 130,000 Mexicans were so detained and deported. So the general figure is much, much larger than what meets the eye, what we're seeing on the news every day, individuals concentrating on the Tijuana side. And what are they doing on the Tijuana side? They want to make a credible claim that they're fleeing their country due to violence, due to their affiliation in some group, either political, social, et cetera, or religious, that is targeted by either the state players or political party or gangs, et cetera, and the victims of violence. And not only has the United States reduced the ability of larger numbers of individuals to apply, they've also restricted the criteria to be eligible.
All right.
To apply for political asylum.
Well, because, yeah, gang violence, I think, is no longer considered something for which you can be granted asylum. Isn't that right, Mr. Lopez?
That's correct. And also domestic violence.
Yeah. So those are two areas that many people in Central America have ended up fleeing. Let me bring on briefly from the Center for Immigration Studies Executive Director Mark Krikorian. So what do you think is the fix here?
Well, I mean, the first piece of context we need to keep in mind is that every one of these Central Americans has passed through Mexico. Mexico is a signatory to the UN refugee treaties. It has an asylum system. It grants asylum to several thousand people every year. And in this, with regard to this first caravan that's mostly reached Tijuana now, every one of them was offered the chance to apply for asylum in Mexico. Some of the people in the caravan further south before they got this far did take up Mexico on that offer. These are people who are saying, we don't actually want to flee violence and seek safety because we already have that in Mexico. What we're seeking specifically is a bigger paycheck and joining our relatives, neither one of which is a reason to is a grounds for asylum. And that is proves in the statistics.
So do you think then that most of those individuals, when they go through the immigration court process seeking asylum, they'll be turned down if it can be shown they were offered asylum in Mexico?
No, they should be. That's not the way the law is now. But most of them are going to be turned down anyway. Of all the people, the reporter referred to this credible fear interview. That's like the first hurdle. Most people pass that. That doesn't mean they've applied for asylum yet. It just means that they now can apply for asylum. Half of the Central Americans who pass that first hurdle never even bother to apply for asylum because the goal was never to get asylum. They know they don't qualify. The goal was to apply for it as a strategy to get past the Border Patrol, and then they're basically home free. Of the half that do bother to apply, a small percentage, it's 25%, something like that, end up getting asylum, which means overall the vast majority of people making these asylum claims that they have been coached and had seminars on what words to say, the vast majority of them know perfectly well they do not qualify for asylum in the United States. They are doing it for exactly the reasons we heard a few minutes ago, which is to get their foot in the door And they know perfectly well that unless they get arrested by a cop somewhere, the chances that they'll ever be found by ICE are very low. So this is really just a tool for illegal immigration by other means.
Mark Krikorian, Center for Immigration Studies, Nativo Lopez, Hermandad Mexicana, based in Santa Ana, and Robbie Whelan of the Wall Street Journal, where he's based in Mexico City. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, a lawsuit filed against UCLA by one of its professors and an Asian American organization seeking data which the plaintiffs say could help to show whether the university violates Proposition 209. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you'll join me coming up on Sunday, December 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. It's our next Film Week screening. I've chosen The Artist, the wonderful silent film, Oscar winner, Best Picture of just a few years ago. So it is a modern classic, a superb film that was filmed all in Los Angeles, including much of it at the Tower Theater on Broadway downtown. We'll be at the Theater at Ace Hotel just south of the Tower, and I hope you'll join us. Not only be fun to see the film together Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, afterwards, we're going to talk about some of the great filming locations in Los Angeles. We'll talk about the transition period of films from silent to talking pictures and so much of how Los Angeles was the star of early cinema. That's coming up Sunday, December 2nd, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel downtown. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. Make sure you get yours now. Last couple of screenings were either sellouts or near sellouts. Want to make sure you get your tickets now. Well, on the heels of a federal trial looking at whether Harvard discriminates against prospective Asian American students, University of California facing a lawsuit seeking data that the plaintiffs say can help determine whether the university discriminates against Asian American students. Joining us is Richard Sander, economist and professor at UCLA School of Law. He filed the lawsuit seeking the data. Professor Sander, good to have you with us again.
Good to be here, Larry. Thanks.
So you're looking for specific admissions data, which you think would show whether Prop 209 is violated. Prop 209, which mandates race and ethnicity, cannot be factors in hiring by public entities in California or for college and university admittance. What are the documents you're seeking?
We're seeking individual-level data on the characteristics of people who apply to the university. And this is for all undergraduate campuses at the University of California, not just UCLA. We're also seeking data on the outcomes, grades, majors, graduation rates, and so on, for students who actually enroll in any of the UC undergraduate campuses.
All right. And how might this determine whether race or ethnicity is used? What could be in those documents?
Well, as we saw in the Harvard trial, the key to really establishing discrimination is to use individual level data. You can't tell much when data is simply reported in tables, just looking at, you know, what the distribution of test scores or what the distribution of applicants by ethnicity is and how many get admitted. That really can't let you get at the nuts and bolts of what's going on. So we're seeking data similar in some ways to what the parties on both sides of the litigation at Harvard had.
We invited the University of California to join us to respond, and they declined to make anyone available, but did issue a statement saying the university is committed to fairness and transparency in its admissions practices and compliance with all applicable laws. The petitioner's lawsuit alleges a single cause of action, violation of the California Public Records Act, for declining their request to create and release a customized set of data about individual freshman applicants. As we have explained to the petitioners, creating a responsive report that would adequately protect the privacy of the individual applicants involved would impose an extensive burden on university resources and is not required by state law. UC personnel estimate it would take us weeks of full-time work to create a specialized data set for Professor Sander in the effort to convert data into a format that protects the privacy of students while being forced to set aside other work critical to the university. UC generally denies requests for custom record creation, given the recent increase in such demands on limited staff and resources. And it goes on to say that the trial court in San Francisco 2016 affirmed that public agencies are not required to create new records in response to public requests. Professor Sander, your response to that?
Well, I submitted a public records request in 2008, which the university did respond to. They created a data set pretty much identical to what we're seeking now, covering the period from 1992 to 2006. That took them a couple weeks to do. I think one person was working on it. They charged us $8,000 for the data set. In 2014, I asked for data on the UC law schools, and the university initially resisted. We brought suit, and they settled the suit. They gave us nearly all the data we wanted. They paid my attorney's fees. So, you know, past UC precedent suggests that they do understand that there is a duty to do this. And the fact that they charged $8,000 for a basically identical data set covering an earlier period 10 years ago suggests this is not that burdensome, and we've offered to cover any costs that they incur.
And what are the ways that you suspect the UC might be advantaging certain applicants over others? Are there particular ways that you think that that's expressed short of talking about race or ethnicity?
Yeah, so Prop 2 and I went into effect for undergraduate UC campuses in 1998. And my view is that from 1998 to 2006, the undergraduate schools did a pretty good job of trying to be race neutral. In 2007, UCLA changed its admissions processes very explicitly. They went from a system where they scored a bunch of different applicant attributes to what they call a holistic system, where someone reads the entire file and comes up with a single magical number that they think represents the strength of the applicant. Robert Mayer was commissioned by UCLA to study what the effect of the holistic system was. And we've circulated copies of this report, which I obtained through another public records request earlier this year. The Mayer report, which is essentially an internal UC document, documents that there's very substantial differences in admissions outcomes when you control for all the factors that are available for analysts, and that Asian Americans are systematically excluded from the admissions process. So we already have very strong evidence that at UCLA, the introduction of the holistic system in 2007 started producing discrimination. And we also know that in 2010 and 2011, the UC president's office actively encourage other campuses to start doing what UCLA was doing. So there's a lot of actual and circumstantial evidence to support the idea that UC is no longer race neutral.
Is it possible that that scoring is taking heavily into account financial background, which crosses over to race and ethnicity income group characteristics, and that's what you're seeing instead of race or ethnicity itself?
No, that's actually not possible, because Robert Mayer's study had access to over 100 individual characteristics, including extensive data on the socioeconomic background of applicants. And what we find is that at UCLA during this period, low-income Asian Americans with similar qualifications had a much lower rate of admission than high-income African-Americans. So this is a confounding. It's a departure from using socioeconomic characteristics.
We're talking with UCLA law professor Richard Sander. He is the co-plaintiff in a lawsuit against the University of California seeking access to data that the plaintiffs believe will show that the university is violating Prop 209's race and ethnicity neutral law requirements for entrance into the UC. We'll continue coming up. Our guest from the Inside Higher Ed publication will be with us right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. Dare Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific day. Have a nice Thanksgiving planned. A couple days coming up here. Right now, we're talking about a lawsuit that was filed just recently against the University of California. UCLA law professor Richard Sander and an Asian American group suing the UC system to get information on student admissions to determine whether the UC is violating Proposition 209. That's California's voter-approved law, which makes it illegal for public institutions to use race and ethnicity in their decision-making. Also with us from the Inside Higher Ed publication, editor Scott Jasek. Scott, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it. Is this very much similar to what's going on in the Harvard trial?
Well, in some ways it is. In Harvard and at UCLA, you have universities that say they use holistic admissions. So there's not a formula that if you have this SAT and this GPA, you're in. They're looking at a variety of factors. Now, at Harvard, they explicitly say that they do consider race and ethnicity. At UCLA, they say they do not, but they do consider things such as the challenges or hardships that somebody has faced. That is not unique to Black and Latino students, but many of them may have faced challenges.
Well, and it may be something, too, that in their whole application process are going to know that that's an important thing to include because it shows personal character, overcoming challenges like that. So it's something potentially universities going to be aware of. So is the issue that potentially that becomes a proxy for race?
That would be the fear of critics of affirmative action. There are a variety of factors that UC considers that have some correlation with race. So, for instance, the University of California, and it's not just UCLA, while they consider things like grades, the number of AP and honors courses, they also look at, quote, the quality of academic performance relative to educational opportunities available in their high school. So a student at a wealthy high school might be able to take 20 AP courses. A student at another high school might not be able to take any. So that's factored in. Now, that benefits students of all races and ethnicities who go to the under-resourced high school, but a disproportionate number of Black and Latino students go to under-resourced high schools.
All right. And then what is the potential for action here? I mean, what is it the plaintiffs are seeking, you know, in the case with Harvard? What is the potential here that a judge could order the university, you know, not to consider certain things or to somehow back race out of that? What are the potential remedies?
I think the potential remedy that ultimately the plaintiffs in the Harvard case want is for the Supreme Court to rule that the whole country has to have a 209-like system. Right now, private universities in California can and do consider race and ethnicity. Many believe the goal of the Harvard case is not Harvard, but for a Supreme Court ruling that would invalidate other Supreme Court rulings that let colleges consider race and ethnicity. And if that happens, if you look at what happened with 209, even if Professor Sander is right, and that has not been demonstrated, the reality is after 209, Black enrollment plummeted, Latino enrollment plummeted. Latino enrollment has gone back up, but that is in large part because the population in California of high school students who are Latino has gone way, way up. So there would be a dramatic change in higher education enrollment, at least in the near term, if the Supreme Court were to order the country to follow a 209-style system.
I also wonder if the Latino bump in enrollment that you see, if transfers from community college might be a factor there, because so many California Latinos go through the community college system, and it's a terrific way to be able to transfer to get your second two-year block in the UC.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you look at UCLA and Berkeley, are the UCs that have had the greatest difficulty in enrolling African-American students and the numbers of Latino students that some would like, their transfer admits are more diverse than are their freshman admits. And they're making notably more progress on diversity with transfer admissions. It's important to remember a lot of talent in the United States isn't clear at the time somebody is 17 years old. And somebody in a community college may be a great student, have learned and have had new opportunities, and indeed can succeed at UCLA or Berkeley.
We have Eric, a listener, writes on the page, Professor Sanders' statement that African-American admission rates are showing higher for high-income applicants proved that socioeconomic status couldn't account for the differences found in the data is an absurd logical fallacy. For his assertion to be true, one would have to assume that high-income African-American students admitted were chosen as a result of some kind of bias. Instead, why not make no assumption or make the natural assumption higher-income students are generally admitted at higher rates than lower-income students? Professor Sander, you want to respond to that?
Yes, and let me just tie that into, Larry, responding to some of Scott's comments. First of all, it's a canard that's completely false that Black and Hispanic enrollment plummeted after Prop 209. There were falls at UCLA and Berkeley, but they were largely offset by increases at other campuses. And I'm looking at the data right now, and between 1997, the last year under Prop 209, and 2006, the last year before I say racial discrimination started again, Black enrollment at UC went up about 15 to 20%. Hispanic enrollment nearly doubled. So these claims that are routinely made about the effects of Prop 209 are false. And when you look at graduation rates, when you look at the number of Blacks and Latinos who actually complete degrees, you see an even more dramatic story. You see huge increases in college completion rates for both Blacks and Hispanics. So a key to our entire argument is that during this period when University of California was race neutral, the big beneficiaries were actually African Americans and Hispanics, because the university was building the pipeline. They were doing the types of outreach that they had not done during the pre-209 era, and they were working hard to actually ensure the success of students they admitted. The second point I want to make is that in the pre-2007 era at UCLA, there was a specific rating assigned to life challenges. The UCLA system that existed before 2007 rated people based on personal achievement, based on academic achievement, and based on life challenges. And so they used all these factors that Scott is talking about and came up with race-neutral results. What Mayer found in a study was that after 2007, when you control for all those things, like the quality of school you went and how many AP courses you had an opportunity to take, that's when you saw this really large discrimination after 2007. So these points that are being made just don't have any merit at all.
Scott Jasek, quick response from you, and I need to wrap.
The professor is absolutely correct that the fall off was far greater at UCLA and Berkeley than the other UCs. But it's worth noting, so this year at UC Riverside, which has amazing success at recruiting diverse students and educating and graduating them, only 4% of the student body is Black. 40% is Hispanic. And there are many who say, and I mean no offense to all the great UC campuses, that it matters who goes to UCLA and Berkeley. There were dramatic declines in the number of Black and Latino students immediately after Prop 209, and the Latino numbers have come up. The Black numbers have not.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. I appreciate it. That's Scott Jasek. He's editor of Inside Higher Ed. And my thanks to UCLA professor of law, economist as well, Richard Sander, joining us on Air Talk. His latest book, Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming right up, we're going to talk about what you're willing to give up to get a better work environment. That's all coming up right here on Air Talk. How much are you willing to forego in salary to be able to get other perks in your job? For example, if you could get a shorter commute to work, how much would that be worth to you? What about getting 10 days paid time off versus 20 days off? A job where you set your own schedule or one set by the manager? A brand new analysis have come out from the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's a working paper by researchers at Harvard, Rand Corporation, and UCLA. And they've done an analysis from data that came from a Rand study back in 2015 on American working conditions. So my question for you is, have you ever faced this in your job where you made a trade-off and it was very clear to you what you were giving up in income to get some sort of other benefit, quality of life benefit in your job? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me, Kathleen Mullen, senior economist at RAND and co-author of The Working Paper. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how were you able to quantify this and to figure out what the financial compensation equals when it comes to some job perk?
Yeah, it's a good question. So back in 2015, we fielded a survey called the American Working Conditions Survey to about 2,000 working individuals and actually some non-working individuals as well for this part. And we did two things. One thing is we collected, comprehensive data on the incidence of various job amenities like schedule flexibility, telecommunication opportunities, physical demands, pace, autonomy, things like that. And then the sort of really innovative feature that we're exploiting in our recent research is we offered people basically pairs of different types of jobs. We described them on all of these different characteristics and randomized different characteristics plus the wage. And then we asked people to, choose which job would you prefer, this one or that one, and, a bunch of different times. And from that, we were able to empirically estimate, how much wage essentially they're willing to give up to get a better job amenity.
Now, of course, this is what people say, so we don't know that actually happens in the real world. We're still salary not only carries its practical weight, but emotional weight, too, symbolizes value in the world. Is there any way of pegging what people say versus human action in the workplace?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, the reason that we actually had to kind of do it in this way is because the relationships that you might expect to see between wages and working conditions in the real world are kind of complicated by sort of unobserved factors like, skill or, maybe certain types of education, training that you maybe wouldn't be able to observe. And so in real life, better working conditions and wages could be correlated with these unobserved skills, and you could be using these better working conditions to essentially attract better workers. And so you wouldn't necessarily be able to see these trade-offs. And so the advantage of our research design is that, we're able to, we're able to basically kind of systematically show people different options and see what they choose. So, one thing we haven't been able to do yet, but we will be able to do in the future because we have follow-up data on these people that we've just recently collected in 2018, is we'll be able to link kind of what they say they would be willing to do in 2015 with sort of their working conditions in 2018 versus 2015. And so we'll be able to see if people who say value, schedule flexibility a lot, you know, tend to move into jobs with more schedule flexibility. And so we'll kind of see if they, you know, they put their money where their mouth is. But that's a little bit TBA at this point.
Chuck, in Long Beach, you did this in the real world. Describe what you traded in salary to get benefits in quality of life.
I traded about $40,000 annually the first year or so. But it was well worth it. I just happened to be in the position I could do it. Changed my life. I was able to change my diet, my exercise. And over the past year and a half, I've pretty much made up for it, at least half of that anyway.
So you just made the decision it was worth $40,000 a year to get out of the negative work environment you were in to work from home.
Yeah, it wasn't that simple, but yeah, I was making a career change.
Yeah.
And rather than trying to chase the same thing I'd been doing for so long, I decided I'd just look for something that I could do from home.
What kind of work do you do out of the house?
It's IT related. I do a lot of remote desktop work.
Okay. So you've been building your business over the past couple of years you've been doing this.
That's correct.
All right. So, Chuck, if you have a friend or someone, maybe you have had people in your life ask you about, you know, feel like they're in a position like that, what would you say to them?
I'd say do it. My goal was really to change my lifestyle. I spend way too much time on the road, forced to, you know, eat out a lot, all the expenses involved in that. I just wasn't, you know, going in the right direction.
Yeah.
And, I'm a new person, really, you know, literally.
Chuck, I appreciate it. So glad it worked out for you. $40,000 a year, a lot of money, but obviously that was a positive move for you. Alex in Baldwin Park, you did this as well, I understand, about a year and a half ago. How big a pay cut did you take and what did you get?
I took a pay cut of about 25% to 30%. Which was pretty steep at the time. And what I ended up trading off was vacation days, sick days, and a pension, which I didn't have before. And it was totally worth it because since then I've had children. And even when it was a very small company and we had maybe five people, but I was paid well. But when I had children and stuff like that, I wasn't able to take much time off, maybe just a few days before I had to go back to work.
So all these other perks became all the more important. Alexander in West Hollywood said, because I'm pursuing acting, I can't take a full-time job, so I'm a part-time legal assistant. I'm getting paid less than I could be, but I have the freedom to pursue my dream. That's Alexander joining us from West Hollywood. We go back to our guest, Kathleen Mullen of RAND. So these are great real-world examples, sort of bearing out what your study participants told you.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear, you know, real world examples of what we find in our data.
Yeah, and the people would give up so much in the way of income, you know, 20-25% or $40,000 a year to make that change. What's the practical application for employers as they consider this?
Well, there are probably a couple. So one for sure is if you're thinking about attracting, a very highly skilled workforce, you might want to be thinking about offering a better work environment. If you're kind of trying to decide between increasing the wages and increasing maybe flexibility or autonomy or just sort of better, you know, a better sort of working environment, you may actually get more bang for your buck if you sort of increase the perks. So, you know, that's sort of one, I think, aspect of things. Actually, that's the only one I can think of right now, but I'm sure there are more.
So I'm curious how many companies have you know, sort of taken this to heart and talked to employees about salary versus benefits and you know, got a sense from the employees which way they would want to go. And so often it'd be dependent on life circumstances, as we heard from the listener who, you know, once he got married, had kids, then what he wanted in the way of those perks changed dramatically. Kathleen, thank you very much. Appreciate your joining us today on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me.
It's Kathleen Mullen, senior economist at the RAND Corporation, co-author of the working paper, The Value of Working Conditions in the U.S. and Implications for the Structure of Wages. Formal way of talking about what would you give up in the way of salary to get something in perks. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk with those in the Malibu Ventura County area who've come back to their homes, areas that have been burned by the Woolsey fire. We'll take your calls. Good to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. And for those of you who are going back to your homes and neighborhood where the Woolsey fire created so much destruction, we wish you all the best, and our hearts are with you as you come back to your community. We know how traumatic this has been and can only imagine, even if you yourself haven't directly suffered loss, you have neighbors, you have friends, others who have lost a tremendous amount. Our phone lines are open. I'd like to hear from you about your experience of coming back to your community, whether it's Malibu, Agoura Hills, Thousand Oaks, any of the areas that were evacuated because of the Woolsey or Hill fires. You've come back to your communities. What has that experience been like? What are you dealing with emotionally, either directly because of a loss you've suffered, or in trying to be a good friend and neighbor with those you care about who've lost precious things in their lives? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. 1,500 structures destroyed in the Woolsey fire. Nearly 350 additional structures damaged. Three firefighters were injured in fighting the blaze, which is just incredible. The personnel that were on scene over the course of the week and a half fighting that fire, and the three civilian fatalities, and our condolences to the family members of those who died. Once again, I'd like to hear from you. If you're coming home to your community and have over the past couple of days, what has your experience been coming back into your community that's been so ravaged by fire? 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me, Malibu City Council member Lou Lamont. Mr. Lamont, good to have you with us.
Thank you. And as much as I love your show, I'm looking forward to not being on it every day.
I'm sure you are. I appreciate your willingness. First of all, how are you doing out of all of this and the trauma that you've been seeing and experiencing and that you've been feeling for your constituents?
Well, many of my friends lost their homes, and not only just their homes, they lost everything in it. So I've been hearing a lot of that. I've been trying to do whatever I can to help them at least get into their homes or see what devastation has wrought. And it's a very emotional time for an awful lot of people. And they all have my sympathy and my pledge to do whatever I can to help them to rebuild or whatever it is that they need.
Now, the western part of Malibu was the hardest hit by the fires. Can you describe what the scene is for those areas, those neighborhoods in West Malibu where the fire was at its most intense?
Where it was at its most intense, it was utter devastation. I mean, houses are right down to their foundations. Sometimes there's a chimney left, sometimes not even that. I saw on one part of Point Doom, a Mack truck was literally melted. And, you know, the engine block from a Mack truck is about the size of a refrigerator, and it was just gone. It was astounding. And some of the other areas, it's just... And what's amazing is as you drive through these areas, there are three or four or five houses destroyed, and then there's one that's perfectly fine. And, you know, then the rest are destroyed. It's heartbreaking just to look at it all.
And we're talking with Lou Lamont, who's Malibu City Council member. Again, if you're in the area that was evacuated, you come back home, and even if you come back to find you had no damage, but of course, you know, your neighbors have suffered so much. I'm curious, just hearing your experiences, the conversations that you've had, and your thoughts about the future of your community. And I don't just mean Malibu, of course, because the devastation is not just contained to that city, but in other neighboring communities. 866-893-KPCC, Calabasas, Agora Hills, Thousand Oaks, Moore Park, neighboring communities. 866-893-KPCC, or our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. How much damage was done on the beach side of Pacific Coast Highway, Councilman?
Not a lot of damage was done on the beach side of the Pacific Coast Highway, with the exception, obviously, of Point Doom, which was just devastated on the northwestern part. And it was limited primarily to a few houses on Zumarez, a lot on Doom Drive, and one Demira, which is another street, had unbelievable damage. But that's the only part across the PCH that was really devastated. Most of it was in Malibu Park, near where the high school is and above where the high school is, that area there. There were also incredible damage in the unincorporated part of Malibu, the other part of the 90265 area code, in Corral Canyon and Decker Canyon and Latigo Canyon. There was a ton of damage up there.
All right. And is there any place, is there a Facebook page for people coming back in to share information, Mr. Lamont, or way for them to connect up?
Well, there's wildfire.org, which is something that you should consider going on. But our city website has an awful lot of information, MalibuCity.org. And it also will lead you to other sites that can be helpful.
All right, Renee in Pasadena. Renee, good to have you with us. Share your experience of the Woolsey Fire.
Thank you. One of my best friends got married that weekend, and her husband is a park ranger who works in the Malibu area. And he left to do wedding stuff. Everything was fine. And the weekend he got married, his place burned down. He's on his honeymoon right now, still hasn't returned, but everything's gone. They've notified him.
So he's on his honeymoon knowing that he's going to come back to nothing.
To nothing, yeah.
Wow. Have you had any contact since they left to get a sense of, you know, what the effect has been? It's just hard to imagine you can compartmentalize enough and fully enjoy your honeymoon after experiencing
right.
that.
Yeah, well, I took them to the airport the day that he found out, and, you know, I just asked him, how are you doing? And he said, I don't think it's hit me yet. He said, I'm feeling pretty numb. I'm sure it'll hit me once I come back and see it.
All right.
So, I think he's just trying not to think about it.
Yeah, understandably. Renee, thank you so much. Appreciate you sharing that experience. I mean, there's so many stories. When you're talking about 1,500 structures that are destroyed, the number of lives that this has created upheaval in and loss is astounding. Mr. Lamont, do you have any sense of how many of those structures are within your city that were lost?
We're working on that right now, and we'll have more accurate information. I know that there is at least probably 250, maybe as many as 400. But I don't want to give you inaccurate information.
Sure. And were there any businesses that were lost as a part of this, or were pretty much private residences?
Mostly it was private residences, yeah.
All right. There have been some criticism from residents about evacuations and information that they received. And I know at this point you're just trying to get people back into the community and deal with that. But what's your sense of down the road what the city needs to do to look at communications and these other concerns that have been raised by residents?
Well, you know, obviously we need to do whatever we can to make it even better than it is. But, you know, our evacuation, although it took a long time for people to get out of town, you have to also remember that in that period of time, there were 250,000 people evacuated from the Woolsey fire area. And ultimately, there were, unfortunately, three fatalities. But with 250,000 people, that shows me that, you know, a lot of the evacuation was successful.
Mm-hmm. And I also wonder about, you know, preparing for the rain. Fortunately, it looks like we're not expecting prolonged and heavy rainfall. But has the city been able to make some sort of arrangements, try and deal with potential runoff over the next 24 hours?
Now, we're dealing not only with the city, but with the state and with the county. Right now, widespread rainfall is predicted for Wednesday and tapering into showers on Thanksgiving Day. So even a small round of rain in these kinds of situations could trigger mudslides. And residents need to be prepared for evacuation again. And I do know that the city will reach out as soon as possible to, if evacuations are necessary, with every conceivable way that we can, up to and even including sheriff's cars going with loudspeakers through neighborhoods. So we don't want what happened in Montecito to happen here. And we're taking every possible precaution right now to see that that doesn't happen here.
Is there any tentative timeline for when people, the public, is going to be able to freely move through Malibu without having to prove residency?
Well, it's coming, and hopefully it'll be in the next few days. I do know that a lot of this is determined by how much power has been restored. And up to last night, 86% of the power has been restored. And throughout the whole Woolsey fire area, I know that Southern California Edison has replaced, I have the number, 741 poles in the Woolsey fire area. And there are 644 poles remaining to be repaired. 126 transformers have been replaced. So it is moving in terms of getting power to people, which is one of the key reasons for, you know, maintaining these roadblocks. And as you can tell, on a daily basis, they are moving further and further and further north.
I know the aesthetics pale in comparison to the loss of people's property and mementos and all the other things. But it's also going to be difficult to see those fire-scarred hills for years, and then they'll come back beautifully, but we're going to have to be very patient.
We're going to have to be patient, and we're going to have to be very careful. I think that when we come to rebuilding, we're going to have to look at building standards. And I think one of the most important things we have to look at is our water pressure issues.
So you were able to see significant water pressure problems in fighting the fire?
Yes, there were a lot of water pressure problems, primarily in Point Doom, and a lot of this water is handled by pumps. And when there's no electricity, there's no pump.
Yeah. All right, Councilman, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I know how, I can only imagine how busy you are, but thank you for being with us.
Thank you for covering this. We really appreciate it because it gets information out to our residents, and we truly appreciate your help.
Thank you. That's Lou Lamont, who's a Malibu City Council member, joining us on Air Talk. Eric says, I'm an Agoura Hills resident north of the 101. Our area of the city escaped relatively unscathed. Even so, this fire was a huge wake-up call. I grew up in the area, returned here 20 years ago to raise my family, and I've never experienced anything like this here. Homes in the main developments within the city north of the 101 have burned, and our favorite local areas, such as Malibu Lake, were devastated. Needless to say, many of these areas where we aspire to live have dropped from our list. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, we have much more to talk about, including the use of virtual reality simulations to help aspiring doctors be able to be more empathic with their patients. That's coming right up on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and I sure hope to see you on Sunday afternoon, December 2nd. Theater at Ace Hotel. It's our next Film Week screening series. And I've picked The Artist, the wonderful film of just a few years ago, Best Picture winner 2011. And we're going to see that on the huge screen at the Theater at Ace Hotel itself, historic movie palace from the early days of talking pictures. And then afterwards, I'll be joined by Film Week critics. We'll talk with a consultant for the film and really get a sense of what went into recreating that era in Hollywood, moving from silent films to talkies, the black and white silent film, The Artist. We're going to talk about that coming up. But first, we're talking right now about VR simulations and how they can help those working in the medical profession better understand what their patients are going through. With us is Marilyn Gallucci, who's professor and director of geriatrics education and research at the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine. She is a specialist in geriatric medicine. Thank you so much, Dr. Gallucci. We appreciate your joining us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
So what are some of the ways that medical school students are using VR to better understand their patients?
Yeah, so for the University of New England, this is a fairly new platform for us. We started working with a company called Embodied Labs, and we started last year with that. We got a grant from the network of the National Network of Libraries of Medicine, and from that we found, through our library staff actually, this Embodied Labs and this virtual reality to improve empathy. The first lab that we purchased was called the Alfred Lab, where the students or anyone using the lab becomes 74-year-old Alfred, who is an African-American male with macular degeneration and hearing loss. And so when you put on this virtual reality headset and you put your hands up, they are the hands of Alfred. They are not your hands. And you can interact by taking a cognition test that the physician gives you in the film. And you're interacting with your family members. And it's quite amazing to have this big black dot in the middle that is the effects of macular degeneration, and to hear everything muffled until the physician gives you hearing aids, in which at least that part clears up for you and you can hear normally again. So this has been astounding for our students to go through, because they may have grandparents or loved ones with macular degeneration and had no idea how that manifested itself. They understood in terms of book learning or classroom lecture, but didn't understand from the experience of it.
And why do you think for some students that's difficult to have a sense of it? Because even if you didn't have the precise experience of what happens to the vision of a typical macular degeneration patient, you still have some sense, right, of what the loss of vision would mean, how it would affect your feelings about the world. Do the students only experience that once they're actually physically perceiving it as the patient?
Well, I've made up a story here that students that are in the health professions oftentimes really respond to experiential learning a whole lot better than passive lecture. And they like that hands-on. They really want to understand. And so just the other night in meeting with my students from the geriatrics club, one student said, when I put on that headset and I couldn't see and I had to look off to the side when the physician was standing right in front of me, she said, I understood what macular degeneration was, but it wasn't until I was in the position of Alfred that now when I have patients come to me, if they're not looking directly at me, I'm not going to think that they have some kind of cognitive issue or some other issue going on. I'm going to understand it's because they really can't see me and when I'm directly in front of them.
Is there a potential downside that, you know, when patients present, they have a particular condition that they're dealing with or illness, that it can have almost an infinite number of variations in what the patient is experiencing. Do you have any concerns that physicians and other healthcare providers are going to be thinking of specific conditions within the context of the VR program they used as representative of the condition? In other words, that they're in a sense, not going to be as quick to pick up on their patients who don't fit the same sort of experience as the VR program.
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you. I wouldn't even venture to answer that. In medicine, we certainly have algorithms, methods of following if this condition or this symptom, then it could be that, and to follow that through. But the other thing is we always ask them to look for zebras. You know, not everything is going to be a horse. And especially when you're working in geriatrics, because older adults will often have their signs and symptoms be somewhat different from possibly other adults and definitely from children. So we don't really want to categorize in that way or hold steadfast to those algorithms. But the bottom line here is, for this project, is that if we can get our students to be more empathic about some of the conditions that older adults are going through, and we can do that through virtual reality, then at least we're raising awareness and hopefully opening their hearts. And if I can be very specific about this in one,
sure.
There are two projects that I run. They're immersion learning projects. One is I admit medical students into nursing homes with a diagnosis to live the life of an elder resident for 2 weeks. They're being toileted, they're being bathed, they're eating pureed foods, they're in a wheelchair, they have a nasal cannula, they're wearing Depends. So they are actually living the life of an elder resident for 2 weeks in a nursing home. The other is I immerse pairs of students into an 18-bed inpatient hospice home for 48 hours. Now, in the nursing home immersion, they are recipients of care. In the hospice home, they are providers of care. So they're doing family care with an interprofessional staff. They're doing family support, and they're also conducting postmortem care. On average, in 48 hours, they will experience 6 deaths and as many admissions. Now, I can get about 40 students a year through the hospice home immersion and about 3 students a year through the nursing home immersion. Mm. Through the virtual reality, I can get them through, I can get all the students through that. Not only are our medical students doing the virtual reality labs, but our nursing students, our physician assistant students, our physical therapy, occupational therapy, and social work students. So
that's a huge advantage.
Through virtual reality just goes so much greater. And ironically, with this embodied labs, I immersed one of the co-founders and a scriptwriter into the hospice home for 48 hours before they wrote and filmed the end-of-life lab.
All right. Marilyn Gallucci with us. She is, by the way, on the advisory board of the L.A.-based firm which created these VR videos, Embodied Labs. She's professor and director of the Geriatrics Education Program at the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine. Also with us, founding director of Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab and co-founder of Striver, a company using virtual reality in corporate training, Jeremy Balinson. Thank you, sir, for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be back, Larry. Thanks.
Thanks. So let's talk specifically about empathy building. Are there limits in VR in people's ability to experience empathy or develop empathy using a program versus the real world?
You know, the timing of the show is perfect, and we just published a paper a week ago. The lead author was a woman in my lab named Fernanda Herrera. And this was a project that went on for about 4 years where we got a very large sample of people, hundreds and hundreds. We got a diverse sample of people from different age brackets and socioeconomic status. We followed them 8 weeks later, so we got to figure out how long this treatment lasts And we designed control conditions, to get to your question, Larry, that were designed to really show the limits of when VR works and when VR doesn't. And to summarize this paper, with a very large sample looking 8 weeks later, VR does outperform control conditions. For example, reading about an instance, imagining that you became someone else, when you actually become someone and experience walking a mile in their shoes, that does outperform control conditions, but not every single time. For some things, simply reading about an ailment is enough. For other things, really having to become someone makes a difference. So, you know, in general, we like to say VR is not a magic medium. It doesn't solve all the world's problems. But when you properly design an experience, it does lead to more behavioral change compared to other things, for example, reading or role-playing.
Well, and the scaling that Professor Gallucci was talking about, I mean, obviously a huge advantage. And do you think this is going to become just standard practice in not just medical schools, but other, you know, professional schools before people go out and actually work with the public to have these experiences in VR?
Yeah, so I've been studying virtual reality academically for 20 years and studying empathy for 15, and we've published many papers. What's changed in the world is that we can actually test this theory of scale. So Striver, this company I've co-founded, we've now put hundreds of thousands of employees through virtual reality. And I want to talk about one specific case study with Fidelity. So imagine you're an employee, you're working at Fidelity, and you've got to train to talk to people on the phone and to give them very important advice on, you know, should they take money out of an account, what kind of account will they form. This is a very abstract conversation because the person in the call center has never actually met the person on the other line. And so what we built for Fidelity, first as a pilot study and then as a larger scale study, was imagine you're in VR training in a call center and I hit a button and all of a sudden you go into the living room of the person that you're talking to and you get to look around her house and, whoa, you see she's got crutches and she can't walk and there's a pile of bills stacked up on the table. And what we've shown first in a pilot study was that these employees trained in virtual reality showed more empathy and had better conversations. Now that we've rolled it out at scale, there's a vice president of Fidelity has just released this number. Customer service ratings of people on the phone have increased across the board by 10% after training in VR. So the quality of a phone conversation from a call center employee at scale has improved. And, you know, you're going to see lots of these examples popping up where we go from these really neat academic studies like the one we heard about with the visual disorder to let's put this out at scale and see how, when you put hundreds of thousands of people through, how does it change, you know, the way people do their jobs?
And you compare it to traditional videos that are used for employee education. So it's not, you know, comparing nothing to VR, but VR to traditional videos.
Well, we always go with the best control condition. We don't like to have what I call straw man control condition. So the gold standard in diversity training is role playing. Actively imagining that you become someone else, or, you know, like we just discussed, you know, going to a place and wearing adult diapers and you know, actually having to do these things. And what we've demonstrated is because VR, you can scale it out and you can have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people do it as opposed to a handful. And there's a consistency of training. So imagine the absolute best training scenario that you ever got. The instructor was amazing. Just everything was firing on all cylinders. That's the one you capture, and that's the one you deliver. So in addition to be able to scale, you scale out the absolute best training scenario out there. And, you know, there's, you know, dozens of companies now. Walmart, we're going to put 1 million Walmart employees through virtual reality training in the next year. It's really a tipping point where we've gone from these academic studies to showing that you can train empathy at scale.
All right. I want to thank you both so much. Absolutely fascinating. Jeremy Baylinson, Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. He's the founding director. He's also author of Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. And he's co-founder of the VR corporate training company, Striver. Also, our thanks to New England College of Osteopathic Medicine, Director of Geriatrics Education, Professor Marilyn R. Gallucci. You can share your comments about VR as a way of building empathy on the part of those providing medical care or customer service or anything where you need people professionally to better have a sense of what the people they're working with are going through. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll take a look at the growing range of perfectionism among today's college students. What's behind that? We'll find out after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. I have no evidence to back this up, but I would bet among public radio listeners, there's a high percentage of perfectionists. I don't know, just sort of seems to go the personality type with public radio news. One of the things that we're seeing, according to researchers, is an increase in perfectionism among college students. We see more scoring higher on perfectionism than students of the past. First of all, I'm curious whether you think that's true. If you've recently been on college campus, you've been surrounded by college students, what your thoughts are about that. And secondly, if it's true, what do you think are the reasons behind it? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. A meta-analysis done a number of months ago and published in the journal Psychological Bulletin showed higher levels of perfectionism among American, Canadian, and British college students now than during the decade of the 2000s or the 1990s. With us, the co-author of the meta-analysis, Perfectionism is Increasing Over Time, Thomas Curran, social psychologist and lecturer at the Center for Motivation and Health Behavior Change at the University of Bath in England. Professor Curran, thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Share with us how much of a change we've seen in perfectionism. How big a growth have we seen in the number of people who are perfectionists?
We have, so this is a 25-year study, and across that period, we've seen small but what we call statistically significant rises in perfectionism, and there are a number of elements of perfectionism we considered in our work. The first is self-oriented perfectionism. That's kind of what most people.
I'm sorry, I lost you. What did you say? The first is what?
Self-oriented perfectionism.
Self-oriented perfection. Okay.
That's right. So that's this kind of irrational desire to be perfect. The second is socially prescribed perfectionism, which is the sense that the social environment and others expect me to be perfect. And the third is other-oriented perfectionism. It's this idea that, you know, you expect others to be perfect. And what's interesting in our analysis is that all those three saw increases, but it was socially prescribed perfectionism, that sense that everyone expects me to be perfect, that undertook the largest increase.
Interesting. And is there a way of tracing that to whether that's largely parentally induced or comes from peers or is institutional? Can you get to that?
This wasn't a causal analysis, so we can't definitively answer that question. But we speculate on certain things. I think most people will recognize that there's been young people today have grew up in a much different culture, should we say, to previous generations, particularly think of the visual culture and the prominence of things like social media. So we certainly think that plays a role. But we also think they're subject to a lot more educational expectation. Things like standardized testing have become quite commonplace. And those pressures are certainly felt by young people from a very young age. So we also think there's something there.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of evidence to suggest that parents are changing their behaviors to respond to some of those increased educational expectations. And perhaps that might be interesting.
Yeah. We're kind of losing you there. We're going to see if we can establish a better phone connection with our guest, Thomas Curran, at the University of Bath in England. One of the things I was wondering, since it looks at college students, is so many more college students today go to graduate school than did previous decades of college students. And so there's just a lot more pressure when you're in college, not just a matter of graduating, but you want to have now, if you're going to go to grad school, your highest possible grades, you want to be able to get into a selective graduate program. That probably is an institutional factor for this as well. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I also wonder, is it possible that there is something expressing itself with perfectionists marrying perfectionists, that we're actually seeing with inborn tendencies expressed more in the population? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Nina, joining us from Buena Park. You're a grad student, I understand?
Yes, I am a grad student, and while I was in college, there were certain classes that I was required to take for my degree. However, these classes were only offered once a year. So if I hadn't passed that class in that first year, I would end up having to take a whole extra year to finish my degree, and that's really a push for students to be perfect in all of these classes that they're required to take for their undergraduate degree, because unfortunately, with the rising cost of tuition, taking another year at for your university can not be an option for some students because of their financial situation.
No, that's an excellent point. And how much of it do you think is parental pressure that parents have higher expectations for their kids' academic success?
There's definitely a hard push. There's also a hard push to finish within the 4 years that is seen as normal. However, it's getting harder, as you said, that grad school. We want to have those leadership positions. We want to have the volunteer, the internships, and with all of those things, plus many students work to sustain their life throughout college, having that many things on the plate, it's very difficult to finish in 4 years. But parents think that taking that extra fifth year doesn't makes us less competitive for grad school, or it makes it seem like we're falling behind what is society's norms.
Well, and it also it adds 25% to the cost of the undergrad education if there's a fifth year. So it may be more humane for the student to take an extra year to get just the classes the student wants, but I'm sure both the student and parents are looking at the costs of doing that. Nina, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing your experience and kicking off the conversation on perfectionism among college students. Patty in La Crescenta, thank you for joining us. You've seen this play out with your daughter?
Yes, it's amazing. She wanted to quit when it was midterms, and she made it through, her meltdown. And then she wanted to quit right before finals. And she said she just couldn't, she didn't want to present something that was not absolutely amazingly perfect. And yeah. I said, just turn in something the school is so expensive that she's going to. And I've been making a lot of sacrifices. And anyway, so yeah, I've seen it my own daughter. When I heard it on the radio just now, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not alone.
This is your life. So, Patty, how have you tried to help her through this?
Well, okay. Let me see. I want to make it concise. I've helped her physically with the creation of the model. I've totally helped her with, the tuition, 100%, and her daily-day money, financial situation. She doesn't have to work or anything.
But I guess emotionally through the perfectionism, that barrier that she couldn't turn it in unless it's perfect.
Yeah, I think she's very competitive. She wants to be the best. She wants to stand out among her peers. And she would rather quit than turn in anything that's, not as up to par for her.
Yeah. Hey, Patty, thank you for sharing the experience. I'm sure you speak for many parents. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dane calls us from Venice. Dane, you just graduated college last year. What have you seen?
Well, Larry, I studied liberal arts, and so most of our homework and essays were done, turned in online. And there's a lot of online grading systems now for plagiarism, spelling, and grammar. And so a lot of things that might have gone unnoticed by a professor's eyeball are now computer graded, things like commas, periods, general errors that are now marked down because things are pumped into a computer system where they're marked digitally.
Interesting. And so everybody stresses out over awaiting those grades.
definitely you need to be a lot more careful, and a lot of students pay for these services as well, like Grammarly.com, to make sure that you have minimum or no plagiarism errors or spelling errors, even things that were minor or maybe unnoticed at the time.
Dana, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. We'll continue with more listener calls. Perfectionism on the rise among American and British college students. This from a meta-analysis published in the journal Psychological Bulletin. We're pleased to have with us the co-author of that meta-analysis from the University of Bath in England, Thomas Curran. We'll hear from more from him as we continue back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A pleasure to have you with us. I don't know if you saw, there was a video of an older woman, younger man who just struck up a conversation. I think it was at a McDonald's over lunch, became fast friends and sort of, you know, became viral. Made me think about, you know, all the experiences that people have spontaneously meeting someone, or an act of kindness starts off an introduction, and fast friendships come out of that. I'd be interested tomorrow on Air Talk to hear your experiences. If you have that sort of, you know, a chance meeting or asking to share a table with someone, a restaurant, something like that, and a long-term friendship came out of that, maybe even a relationship, we'll hear those stories. Talk about it tomorrow on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. Right now it's perfectionism among college students and what the factors might be behind this. Thomas Curran of University of Bath in England, we just heard some interesting accounts from listeners. Quick comment on any of those anecdotes.
Yeah, they were really good contributions. I think I mean, I've read a couple of things down there, but a lot of that I hear myself as mentor to a lot of young people as a tutor. Particularly the first one around competition and the kind of unrelenting pressure to meet what are now society's quite, I would say, quite lofty goals. A lot of research is suggesting now that the college premium is restricted to those with advanced degrees. And you can tell, you know, students feel that pressure. And it is a lot of pressure because not everyone can attain or has the material resource to attain an advanced degree. So I do have a lot of sympathy with students, and I know that they feel that. The parent that called in, I think, was another excellent contribution around students just being unable to derive that sort of lasting sense of accomplishment and feeling like, well, what's the point in trying if it's not going to be perfect? This is very common amongst perfectionists. You know, you can't fail at something, you don't start. And so they do have a tendency to withdraw because if they feel like they're not going to succeed or they feel like it's going to be perfect, that kind of fear of failure stops them even starting. So that's a really interesting account.
Yeah.
We see that a lot.
Jeffrey in Mount Washington, I understand you're an ex-perfectionist?
Yes, absolutely. I had such a problem trying to control every aspect of my life to be perfect that I was just driving myself insane. And I finally realized that my perfectionism would never make me happy. Like, I was totally always setting myself up for failure because I would, you know, paint this picture of what everything had to be and how everyone had to act. And when things didn't work that way, I was let down, and which led to me just being let down all the time. So I focused more on just embracing what I could do well. And when it wasn't perfect, I just embracing that I did the best that I could. And that really helped with my depression and with my cycle, just, you know, being able to function in the world.
Jeffrey, was this a lifelong thing for you? Were you even as a little kid a perfectionist?
No, I wasn't. I was a really horrible student in school. And once I started working, actually, at 18, I started working at McDonald's. And that started instilling this, you know, everything has to be right. You know, the whole McDonald's model of, you know, every customer out. And I would get, you know, validation from doing a really good job. And then as time went on, you know, it just built up, and, you know, I started building my life and having my friends and doing activities that were all based around what a perfect man was supposed to be, you know.
That's so interesting that you were an adult, a young adult, when you learned perfectionism and it became so a part of you that it was interfering with your life. That's amazing how quickly you adapted to that. But it sounds like you got so much positive reinforcement for it that's what led it then became so valuable. So how do you feel you are now, Jeffrey? Have you been able to make the break?
I still catch myself, trying to impose perfection on other people. You know, and I just have to stop myself, take a breath, and just let it go. You know, it's not in my control. I cannot control other people. I cannot control their actions. I cannot make them be perfect, which makes, you know, so that's really what it came down to, is trying to control other people.
Yeah.
If I can't control the situation, then it can't be perfect. Hence, I could never be perfect.
Yeah, it could never be perfect. That's right. Jeffrey, thank you. I appreciate your call. Monique writes on the page, I work at a community college, and in my experience, the honor students chase high grades just as they did when I was in school in the 90s. Seems like most Southern California students currently are less committed to hard work and perfectionism and learning for fun. I wonder if it might be the influence of larger class sizes in primary secondary education in California, or the rise of online education, lower expectations. I don't know, Monique. It's an interesting question. I mean, I'm a public school kid, product of LA Unified Schools, and we had very big classes when I was going. I don't know. The classes are on average larger now, for example, than they were in the past, at least in major cities like Los Angeles. But interesting, your observation, you don't see it so much. Dennis, in Pasadena, you're a grad student. What is this like for you?
To be honest with you, being a person of color, there's already a pressure on myself to do very well, because I know that statistically speaking, we're not expected to even go into grad school, you know, let alone as I go into a bachelor's program. So there's already that pressure there. And being an older adult, I'm 37 years old, and I honestly feel there's a constant pressure to do is excel beyond what is your average student grade as far as getting an A at all times. And the reason being is because I'm trying to apply for a PhD program, and it is extremely competitive.
Yeah.
To a point that it just becomes intimidating. And I guess the other thing, too, is that I feel the pressure from everyone around me as far as expecting me to get into this PhD program. So there's a lot of different factors that come into play.
Dennis, do you feel kind of like you're carrying their hopes too, in a sense that they're vicariously living through your success, your achievement?
Yes, to a certain degree, I do feel that, because I know that most of my family was not able to go to college, let alone even finish high school. So to see me excel to this point, it's mind-blowing for some of my family members. And for some of my friends, it's a good motivation, because they strive to want to reach the level where I'm at. And my friends are a little bit younger than I am, and I'm constantly telling them, like, do not allow anybody to tell you that you cannot succeed or that you cannot excel, you know. And I try not to push that perfectionism on them.
Yeah.
I also try to have them realize that it is extremely competitive, and if you do not put your full effort into school, you're not going to be able to excel or beyond the BA program.
Dennis, thank you so much. I appreciate, you know, I don't know if you're the first in your family to go to college, maybe not, but I mean, it's one of the things I know college and university is really trying to deal with, to help first in their families deal with the kind of pressure that comes along with that. Thank you for that call. Thank you for joining us. Have a terrific afternoon.